Terrific. So what's new in your world?
Oh, what is new in our world? Wow.
You got an opening out of the way?
Yeah, we've got all our openings done for right now, and so that's really good news. Although, yeah, so, you know, and the really funny part is I think that what we always think is if we do an opening with a new concept that the big deal is getting the opening and executing, but the reality is you're always refiring.
Mm-hmm. Can I speak to Lorenzo?
I got the wrong number.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, that's interesting.
There you go. So anyway, that's the interesting part because you're always coming back and working it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been true in the, let's see, what have we done? 1, 2, 3 restaurants this year and then a retail store. It's been true in every single one of them that the reality is different. But in every one of them, it's been something different that needed to be done. You know, either we didn't meet the market in terms of what the market wanted, or we met the market in terms of the food, but in terms of the business pattern, it turned out to be different than we thought it would be, so you're adjusting to that. Or in one of the cases, we went into a suburban area. You know, we went out to the Sammamish Plateau.
Yeah, right.
And that turns out to be really pretty much, talk about ongoing training. It's ongoing training and then some, because of the age group that you're working with in terms of it was tough recruiting to begin with, so you tended to get a lot of young, enthusiastic people, which was great, except that things that we forget are not basic to people's understanding about restaurants. You know, just basic stuff like, you know, everything really basic in terms of skill levels from carrying a tray to, you know, to how to take an order, that kind of stuff, which, you know, typically in our fine dining restaurants, we're not doing a whole bunch of that. So, you know, that's one piece of it. But then the other piece of it is trying to get people to focus, to be guest focused, as opposed to, as opposed to being, you know, eye centered. It's
mm-hmm.
a very interesting thing. We were having a discussion about that the other day, which is for a lot of these guys, this is the first time that they have really needed to focus outwardly. The focus has been pretty much inward. You know, it's been on, me doing well in school, me doing well in sports activities, you know, me doing well with my circle of friends. And, you know, there's a lot of obvious social things that come with that. But what's been very interesting is trying to put the guests first, which, because, you know, being a huge fan of gratuities, tends to happen, I think, almost naturally to a certain degree. People recognize that. With this group, you have to educate the connection between income and guest satisfaction, which I know that sounds just odd because it seems to me it's such a kind of a normal thing. If you've been in the industry at all, you get that pretty quickly, but it needs to be taught. And so that what we just did was actually it was really fun. We kind of stumbled on this. We did the guest bill of rights for the restaurant.
Ah.
I have the right to. I have the right to be recognized immediately, for you to look at me, smile at me, talk to me. I have the right to have my order taken quickly. You know, I have the right for my children to be taken care of. Those kinds of things, and it seems to be working because they get that. You know, I can put myself in the place of the guest, which has been kind of hard for them to do. So.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the airline in a very negative way. You know, the airline passengers' bill of rights.
Yeah.
This is much more. You know, that's all about if we mess with you. This is all about, you know, what is my right when I come into this restaurant as your guest? So, you know, how do I expect to be treated? So.
And why do you, I mean, is that because they haven't been exposed to it or because mom and dad have been paying their expenses and they haven't?
Yeah, I think that's some, I mean, not entirely some of it, but a lot, it's not that this isn't a willing group of people. I actually had a, interestingly, I had a reporter from the Puget Sound Business Journal call and ask me if we found on the east side that these guys didn't want to work very hard and they were basically spoiled. He said, I don't know how to say this politically, this is what I've been told by a couple of other operators. And I said, that's not our experience at all. Our experience is they just don't know.
Yeah.
And they're willing. It's not a question of are you willing. It's just that you have to help them connect the dots. They're not going to make the connection on their own. So... That's kind of been an interesting thing. because I think typically, and you know, that you know, I think obviously gratuity is a wonderful thing because that helps people understand if I serve you, I will be rewarded for that. For the you know, for these guys who have been outside of the restaurant professional circle, that has, you know, as I said, we're helping them connect the dots. And it's kind of interesting too, because then they go, it's not even so much the Jim Sullivan, you know, philosophy of let up, sell and sell. It's just about, you know, the basic courtesies.
Yeah, I'm of course not a major fan of pushing the check anyway, because I think you can get the check and lose the guest.
Oh sure.
You know,
absolutely.
if they don't get the, you know, it's not about what the number comes out. It's the number that I'm interested in is how often do they come back.
Right. Right, which is, you know, particularly in a neighborhood or in a suburban area, that's giant. I mean, that's giant. I think in an urban area it's still important, but, you know, when you also have other, you know, you have people who are coming in on business expenses.
A little more transient.
Business expenses or their, you know, yeah, or even people are different about their own personal income than they are about business spending.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that. You know, so they're willing to say, oh, all right, this is great. I'm entertaining a client. You know, I want to have whatever the client, this is going to make the client experience the best. And that's the total cost is secondary. And I think if you're, you know, spending your own personal income, that reverses. I want to have a good experience, but I want it in balance with the value that I, or the cost that I perceive is appropriate for this experience.
I mean, certainly one of the things that, that forces people to get it. I'm here in the business center at the Marriott in Cincinnati right now, so if we've got copy machines running and all that's in the background. So if anybody's listening to the tape and is wondering what all this noise is, that's what all this noise is. I was wondering, though, you know, if you have sort of, I guess, the stereotypical spoiled urban suburban youth who haven't, you know, where they haven't really had to worry about money because mom and dad took care of it. If the tip income is that much of a driver?
Just one second. Sorry, I'm just sending my daughter out the door here.
Oh, okay.
Go play. I think tip income still is a driver. And you know, the reporter who said these guys are spoiled really surprised me. I mean, we're in a neighborhood in this new restaurant where the average household income is around $95,000, so that's pretty significant.
Yeah, sure.
But you also, you know, the caveat there is that the average house payment is probably $80,000.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, so it's all relative.
Sure.
And I think these kids definitely, they want to make money, I mean, while they're there. And I just think that somehow... the connection hasn't been made in the industry between for them, you know, to the industry, and the fact that the better job that you do for the guest, the more you make if you're in a tip role. And that's really true in any role, actually, but in a tip role in particular, it's pretty immediate gratification. And so I think that a lot of them are amazed when they figure out how much money they really can make. You know, how good it really can be.
Now, you brought some staff over from current operations, though, didn't
you? We did. And pretty much those staff, for the most part, were borrowed because it's, you know, again, it's in other parts of the country, it's not going to sound like a long hike, but it's about 40 minutes or so from downtown Seattle to get to this particular location. And so for a lot of people, that's really a long commute.
Yeah.
And so you really need to be in the area, and as a result of that, most of the people we brought over who were trainers and who stayed on really started to go back to their home restaurants within a month or two.
Because I was wondering if that message might not, or if you tried to get that message across sort of from on a peer level from one server to another to say, look, here's the way it really works.
That's a great point. That is a great point. And
I just wonder, you know, it's sort of, you know, don't distrust authority. And you know, sometimes I get an interesting comment in an email from a guy who said, you know, I was just, my crew wasn't getting behind the training, and so we talked to him and asked him about it, and their comment was that they thought that the corporate trainer was talking down to them.
Well, that's interesting. I think that's really, I think it's dangerous because I think it's hard sometimes for people to see that. And, you know, we talked a lot about that at the last chart conference where people were talking about, you know, meeting people communication-wise where they are and where they need to be in. And I had to laugh because the guy who's in charge of training for Hard Rock Cafe, who to me, I perceive him as being young, told me he was perceived by a lot of their crew as being old.
Ah. Oh, Jim Knight?
Yeah, Jim Knight.
Yeah. He's
just a wonderful guy. So, you know, it's all relative, isn't it? But I do think that that's really important. And I also know that as the trainings continue to improve, as we've transitioned from people who were corporate trainers to people who are in-store trainers. Because, you know, they live in that environment with that world of expectation.
Uh-huh. We have someone else.
All right.
Hello. Hi, this is Edmund.
Edmund Wu.
How you doing, sir?
From Greenville, South Carolina.
Yes, sir.
And we're on with Molly Hancock.
Hi, Edmund.
That's great.
Hi, Molly. How are you, ma'am?
I'm great, thanks.
I really enjoyed the tape.
Oh, thank you. And Bill says thank you, too.
Yeah. No, Edmund is one of the perpetual students of the industry. He really impresses me that way. We'll go out with a bunch of operators, and we're sitting there doing some serious research on the wine, and he's back in the kitchen talking to the dishwashers.
That's great.
Am I the only one?
At the moment.
At the moment? Okay.
At the moment. But anyway, we were talking about staff training and helping people get it. Molly was saying they had just opened a new restaurant in a suburban location, which was a new one for them, and part of the problem was just making the connection for these young servers between what sort of experience the guest has and how that impacts on their income, because they didn't get it.
So what did you do to get them to get it, or to help them get it?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things we did was, I was telling Bill, is we just developed what's really kind of a guest bill of rights for the restaurant to put them in the place of the guest so they could see what the guest expectations were. And by the way, Bill, what I didn't tell you is we did some fairly extensive research to find out exactly what guests did want.
Mm, okay.
And that's where that came from. So the guests told us what they really wanted from this particular restaurant was good food. That was kind of went without saying. But they also wanted to be greeted quickly. They wanted to be served quickly. And they wanted people to be friendly to them, but for them, the promptness was very important because we're in a community where there's a fairly high income, but a lot of these people are double income folks with families. And so when they're going out to dine, they don't mind driving, they don't mind the car time, but once they get there, they want to have the meal take place and be in progress, and they want their children to not distract from their experience, so the kids are engaged the entire time. And for them, there's a real timing issue with that. So that kind of was the first step to say, here's what the guests are really telling us. You know, let's put ourselves in that place. And then what Bill was talking about before he came on also, Edmund, is how important it is to have people who really are communicating, you know, who are part of it. And as we have transitioned from having had corporate trainers to trainers that come out of the restaurant crew itself, I think that really increases the connection.
Mm-hmm.
It really increases the connection. But we found that we had to train specifically. We are trained specifically to connect the guest satisfaction, guest experience to income level.
Well, when you have your in-house someone that's coming out of the ranks, is that a lead server or
for us?
Yes.
Who's doing the training?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and typically that's somebody that has pretty much risen to be a crew leader,
mm-hmm.
and who enjoys that kind of role, who enjoys that interaction. What we found is that there are some really great servers who really don't enjoy coaching other people, and so we try to go with people who are very good servers but really enjoy the development of others. That's more important to us, that they're mm-hmm. the development of other people, as opposed to they may not be the top gun in terms of check average or guest comments or you know, how they interact and team workers with other crew members on the floor. But the people who train that do the great job are the people who really have the connection, who want to do it.
How much do you typically pay them more when they're actually training? Is that classroom training or on-the-job training?
On-the-job training, and we typically are paying them. First of all, just to put this in perspective, we're in a state which has the highest minimum wage in the country with no tip credit, so it's $6.50 an hour, no tip credit. So we're typically paying the trainers $1 to $2 more an hour, and they get a few other perks, like part of the training program, they are sitting down and eating with the person that they're working with or the people, and so they're pretty well fed during that training time frame. We also have some other programs for them, some additional training opportunities and fun opportunities, too, where we bring in people to talk with them and who are really pretty much experts outside the industry. So they have those kind of advanced development opportunities as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you're training, are you talking about eating, or is that just tasting, a part of the menu every day they're training?
They do that, but we also have them sit down and have a dining experience because we want them to see what it's like to be a guest and be served at the table.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's good.
We used to do a thing where when they would go through the training program, at the end we would give them a gift certificate to go out and dine. But what we found was that was nice, but what's even more helpful and really jump-starts them is to sit down with a trainer and dine.
Mm-hmm.
Because the trainer can be talking them through the whole meal, the service sequence, what is happening, what could be happening, and they get a real chance to experience it. And, we all know how different it is to sit at a table in a restaurant than it is to be standing and moving.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you did some research.
Yes.
About what the guests wanted in the new location. How was that done?
We did it actually with a research firm who did phone surveys. And, there's a lot of different ways that we have employed in the past to find that out. We've done phone surveys. We have done exit surveys with guests who come into the restaurant, ask them a few questions on the way out and giving them some kind of return certificate to thank them. We have also done focus groups. For me, the focus group is, I'm the most suspect of a focus group. It takes a lot of skill to conduct one well.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the phone surveying, exit surveying are really great.
What have you found? What differences have you found? You said you were trying to figure out what they wanted in this particular restaurant. How does that differ from what you found in some of the city restaurants?
Well, what's really different is that speed factor that I was talking about with you before. They really want to be in and out of this restaurant in an hour on a weeknight.
Oh.
They don't want to spend a lot longer than that. And
does wonders for the table turn.
Yes, it does. And it really changes. So the service sequence, we laughed, actually, because I think we figured out we had, I'm just going to sound ridiculous, I know, but remember, we're primarily in fine dining. We had something like a 30-step service sequence when you really broke it all down. So we've got it down to, we're shooting for 12. We'd love to have 7. But, if you're counting things like initial greeting, drink order, appetizer order, appetizer delivery, drink delivery, appetizer delivery, you can see how quickly those numbers pile up. But we really have tried to reduce those numbers of steps and combine steps so that we can really expedite the guest experience. So that was the number one thing we learned from them that they really wanted. And, we learned some other things, too, in terms of expectations about total check, and expectations about driving time, which in this particular case is not an issue. We thought it might be. It's not. It's a very mobile community. People are used to being in their cars and driving.
You had said when we first started talking, you're talking about kind of rethinking the restaurants after they've been opened.
Right.
Can you just kind of walk through the process of how you what you're looking for and how you keep tabs on that? Because I know for a lot of folks, they get a place open. Now, you've done it a number of times, so obviously you've got a little bit of experience behind you. But I've known restaurants that were doing huge volumes and losing money for 6 months and never knew it.
Right.
Because they were too busy, chasing their tail on other things.
Absolutely.
So what sort of things do you look for, and how long do you let something go before you determine that it's real and not just a blip on the radar?
Well, the first, you can't tell in an opening what the real reception is by the numbers. That's just flat out the fact, because people want to go, at least in our experience, to a new place and see what it's like. So they're going to come and check it out, and they might drive farther, or they might go to a restaurant that may not be going to wind up on their top five awareness list because it's new and they want to see it. And so typically, and also people want to be part of something where it's happening. So you have to really look at that opening volume, you know, with kind of a jaded eye, I think, because...
And what do you typically think that period is? 6 months, 3 months, a year?
Oh, I think it depends on the size of the demographic reach, you know, how big your really circle is that you're drawing from. But I think that the typical initial blast is really a few months, usually 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's a typical trial period if you're in a... You know, in a community that's not too giant. I think if you're in a community like downtown Seattle, it's probably quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. You know, you have to look at that. Number two, what we do from day one is have comment cards available to people. And we put them everywhere and ask people specifically what they think about the experience. And we have, we find people are really verbal about it. In the comment cards, and you know, we also are at the table talking with them, but interestingly, in writing is where you find out how people really feel.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the beginning, when it's new and it's exciting, you know, they're not going to want to take somebody's time, or frequently they're with other people, they're with guests, and they're hesitant to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll tell you in writing what they think, so we look at that.
Now, you're handing these to them before the meal, after the meal, they're on the table if they choose to do it?
We put them in the guest check, and we direct people's attention to them. And sometimes what we'll do, too, is incentive servers to make sure they get comment cards back with their names on them. A little dangerous because you don't want servers telling guests what to write.
Right.
But, you know, when you're at the beginning in particular, we're really shooting to get a lot back, a lot of feedback from people. For two reasons. One is because we want to know what they think, and number two is we want their name and address so that we can incorporate them into our guests, frequent guests or VIP program.
Hmm.
Actually, I have another question. I didn't want to...
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I feel like I'm talking and Bill's not getting a chance to...
No, that's fine. This is for your benefit. So.
Okay. One thing that I picked up on listening to the tape,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about how you know, different people have... Your employees have different interests, and or they're just wired differently.
Mm-hmm.
At one of my operations, the lead one is a dinner house. It's a state's fish wild game, mm-hmm. $25 check average kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
My manager there is a very analytical kind of guy. He gets his deposits done on time. He gets his numbers. He can tell you, you know, food costs down to whatever, blah, 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 blah. One of the things that we have determined, and a lot of this through my association with Bill, is that for that type of casual fine dining, so forth, so on, that we need a strong figurehead presence kind of person to work the tables and mm-hmm. so forth, so on. And we have a name recognition program and all that kind of stuff that we're trying to put in place. Frankly, though, he is not very good at that aspect. You know, he's not very good. He's not comfortable always working the tables.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I found out when I worked for him when he was gone on vacation was that and the way I approached the name recognition program, that I think the staff was relatively flabbergasted at the length I was doing to greet each and every table by name.
Mm-hmm.
And which obviously he wasn't executing on,
mm-hmm.
which he had been telling me he had been doing a reasonable job of doing. And then in a separate operation, a tavern concept, I have a manager there who is just absolutely great on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great with the guests. He's really helped build the sales there and so forth, so on. But, you know, I can't get him to turn in workable numbers on time. I mean, every single week I have to beat him in the head to get him to come to the weekly management meeting. Mm-hmm. With his numbers in line,
yeah,
and have them be reasonable, and we're such a small operation. Both of these places are doing, you know, basically nighttime only, dinners only operations. They're doing 1.1, 1.2 mm-hmm. operations, so I can't afford to have two or three or four managers, each one doing different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can actually pay any one manager is not a lot when you compare it to, you know, what people are getting paid at the big chains.
Right. So. You know, this is a perennial dilemma, honestly. I mean, it doesn't go away no matter how large your company is or how big the restaurant is. Different people are suited to different things. And, you know, there's that old saying about don't try to teach a pig to sing. It just irritates the pig.
So we need my only pig.
Yeah, he's the only pig, but here's an idea for you. Actually, we did this. This is very funny because, you know, we go through this all the time, and you're always trying to balance teams based on skills and direction. So here's a thought. People are always impressed when it's a general manager who comes to their table, I think. But I think that's really secondary to recognition. And mm-hmm. I don't think it is, and I don't know the size of the available dollars you have, but I think it's they just want to be recognized by someone consistently. And one of our challenges is our restaurants are larger, so on larger scale restaurants, $5, $10 million restaurants, general manager can't work every night. And neither can any one department manager, really. And besides, you want them focused on things that you've already identified, the financial success of the restaurant, crew communication, those other kinds of things. So what we have really done is create a second tier of people who are very guest-focused. And actually, we kind of have, in some of the restaurants, almost what's a maitre d' position. They work the desk, but they also work the floor. And they're tipped by the crew, so that really enhances their opportunity for income. And so they're not salaried, but they're people who just love guests, and they love to make magic on the floor in the dining room.
Kind of the hospitality core.
Yep, that's right. And the great news is that if that's your job 5 nights a week to do that, the chances that they're going to see your guests, if they don't work on, say, Monday and Tuesday night or whatever their nights off are you know, pretty high, that the guests who come in are going to see them and they're going to remember them and they're going to greet them and do that kind of stuff. And
what do you typically pay someone like that?
Well, you know, we pay them, you know, we have a very different economic situation in the Seattle area because of not only extremely low unemployment but also the minimum wage. So, you know, for us, we have people who are making, who are doing those jobs, who are making $10, $12, $13 an hour. But they make great livings, believe me, based on the tip income.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't
know. The 10 to 12 is your base, and plus a tip out.
Yeah, and some people actually make more than that, depending on if they have other responsibilities. But you know, these people are typically making than $40,000 and more a year because of the tip income, and that's based on either. Amount per head that's seated that the server tips back on or a percentage of their total ring. And the thing is that it's really obliges them then to be totally interactive with the guests in there because the servers know, you know, the servers are paying part of their gratuity to them. The servers are going to demand from them that level of service. It's actually worked out very well.
I've had a lot of comments and a number of the topics that sort of swirled through the electronic house call newsletter related to tip sharing, setting that up. I mean, it's in one way, it's not your money, but it is your money, and who gets to say, and so forth. What was your experience with that? In terms of, because I gather there was a point when this position did not exist.
Correct.
And to get there and to have servers be willing to pay for it would you kind of walk through the process of that?
Sure. Well, you know, we all know it's always easy to set anything up you want when you're opening.
Mm-hmm.
That's great if you can do it then. But in reality, since we're long-term operators, we don't very often, you know, we've done 3 openings this year, but we don't very often get to set things up from the beginning. So we actually, in this one case where we brought in somebody who was in one of our other restaurants, interestingly, who had been in management, and he was like the guy that works for Edmund at the tavern. He was just dynamic and wonderful in terms of guest interaction, but he wanted nothing to do with scheduling, with financials, with other stuff. We said, this guy's really too good to lose. He's not in a good fit. He recognized he wasn't in a good fit, and we said, okay, you know, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to do this kind of hospitality thing. And we said, this is great. We can't compensate you at your management level, obviously, so here's what typically we're paying in this strata hourly, and then the rest will need to come from gratuity. So then, and this is in a dinner house, pretty high-end dinner house where people have worked, long-term people. So what the management did was they took a period of comment on it before they brought him in, and then they went back, and we had one guy who was just excellent at this, one manager, went back and went one-on-one with people and said, we've heard your input, we know exactly what you think. Some people don't agree with this, but we've made a decision to do it, because remember, it's a voice, not a vote. You know, we're giving people an opportunity for comment, and we're going to do it this way, but I would like to keep the dialogue open with you so that if you have issues, you can come to me. And what happened was, because this guy was very good and he did what he said he would do, the opposition went away. And that's been true in other places. We also do have wine captains in some of our restaurants who are tipped, but that's pretty easy for people to work with when we've introduced it, because typically they see their sales go up in terms of wine, and so they're making more money anyway, and to tip a percentage of that back out is not an issue for them.
Did the tip go up when you added your hospitality guy?
Absolutely. That was the other piece of it, is that the servers felt that they really had somebody on their team, a representative who was making sure that the guests in the door experience was great, and that they were really just totally focused on taking care of guests, kind of almost like a concierge on the floor.
Now, this is different than your greeters.
Yeah, absolutely. Different from the greeters. The greeters are still doing what they do, and these people, because they're men and women both, will be, in the lobby kind of greeting people as they're walking through the door, but they're also on the floor, so they're just making a circle as fast as they can back through, except for when they're stopping with a guest. So typically they're bringing the guests in the door a lot of times, and they're going through the dining room at pretty regular intervals, touching base with the guests. Managers are still doing that too. It's not that that's gone away for the managers, but manager typically will be called away, point of sale problem, issue in the kitchen, issue in the bar, bartender needs change, any number of things that you can think of they might have to deal with. So these hospitality people are not burdened with that. They're totally focused on the floor.
Well, what kind of percentage are they being tipped out? Is that percentage of sales, of the server sales?
Yeah, they are, and it really varies. Typically our servers are tipping back out again, about 30% of what they've taken in.
Mm-hmm.
As an aggregate, but those tips are going to the desk staff, the server assistants, and the bar, as well as these people,
mm-hmm.
wine captains.
Did they establish all those? I mean, how were all the various percentages established? I think that's one of the
How do you do that?
One of the stumbling points for people, because
right.
You sort of say, well, give me your money.
Well, one of the things that we do, and it's at the end of the night, every server, because our servers are self-banked, which is important, I think, to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
Our servers are self-banked. At the end of the night, they have to do a reconciliation, and it's called a checkout. And at the very top of the checkout, they're filling in from the POS what their gross sales were. And then actually, there's two ways to go. One is with Micros, and I know this is also true with Romanco. You can actually program the point of sale to tell you what 1% or 0.5% or whatever it is by department is, so they need what their kind of guideline for tipping out is. Because of tip tracking, we also have them write down at the bottom, there's a form and there's a percentage, and they write in what it was and who it went to, so we can track the tips, and so it's very accountable that way.
But in terms of the amounts, though, did they say, well, we're going to give the bartender this and we're going to give the bussers that? And
yeah, that was pretty much done by management in conjunction with some key people. And that's been a convention that's been around for a long time in our company. And so then when you start a new restaurant, you just bring that with you. Here's a form. Here's how we do it.
Is the kitchen in that at all?
No. No, we really can't do that because the way that the law reads in terms of directly tip, which says that these people need to have guest contact.
Okay.
So they don't. I know some people.
Is that a California law, or sorry, it's not California, Washington state law?
Interestingly, I don't know what the federal law is, but it is Washington state law.
Mm-hmm.
And there have actually been several lawsuits where restaurants and companies in Washington have had to return money to servers who were required to tip, not directly tip people.
Hmm.
it's legal to say you need to tip in this amount. But, you know, we're flexible, too. If the server comes and says, you know, look, I'm not tipping this amount because I didn't get the support, you say, okay. You know, what are we going to do to fix that?
This is a question on a different tack. Can you talk about what's your typical day, typical week?
My typical day and week?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting, Evan. Well, I'm the CEO of the company, so typically here's what I do. I come in and, oh, let me give you a day. I come in the morning, and the first thing I do is fire up my computer, and I check my emails. I've already listened to my voicemails driving in.
And this is 8 a.m., 6 a.m.?
Yeah, it depends. I have a 11-year-old daughter. I like to stay home with her in the morning until at least 8 if I can. So I typically leave at about 8 o'clock in the morning. Some days, just because of other needs, I'll leave at 7 or earlier. But I try to stay home until at least 8, get her up, get her going, until someone else comes in and takes over. And then so voicemail in the car, email at the office. I go on our network. We have something called a flash report, and I am typically looking not at the previous day but the day before that because, for the most part, our administrative assistants haven't had time to punch it in. So I'm looking at what the sales and labor were every day compared to budget in our restaurants. Now, we have 6 quick serve restaurants, 6 fine dining restaurants, and we have 2 retail operations. So, you know, that's not a whole bunch to look at. It's pretty quick to look at those just to kind of get a sense of what's going on, where sales are trending, how we're doing with labor. So, you know, those are kinds of the check-in things that I do. I typically walk through our office and talk to everybody on the staff when after I get going, because we have flex time, so the people who are in accounting and administrative support are coming in anywhere from 6:30 in the morning until 10 in the morning. So I'll go out and talk to everybody in the office. If I can, I'll typically have meetings with people, you know, returning phone calls, that kind of stuff. I like to go out and observe operations if I can during the lunch hour if I'm not already in the process of meeting with someone. And typically in the afternoons, I will do one-on-ones with the people who report to me, which are, in our cases, our executive team. So that would be our director of finance, our director of marketing, our director of human relations, or human resources, our operations directors, our facility and development director. He's actually our VP. He's just wonderful. And our operations chef.
Are these the people you meet with right, once a week?
I meet with them once a week. Some I meet with every 2 weeks. So that's kind of the typical pattern. Depends on the day of the week. Some days we have an executive team meeting. Other days we have what we call a cuisine meeting, which is with our director of concept and cuisine development. And she's really our chef, creator person, our operations chef, our operations directors, and myself. We'll sit down together and just talk about, you know, what's going on. I have transitioned more in those meetings so that I'm coming in at the end of them and they're telling me what's going on. And they're doing the problem solving themselves, which has been great. So that's pretty typical. Wednesday mornings I do something called, that we do the drill down. And that's been something that is great because we tend to be all very people-oriented. And so sometimes we get away a little bit from what's happening with the numbers. And so I meet with our operations directors for our 3 different divisions on Wednesday morning, and we literally can go through financial results in 5 or 10 minutes.
Is I do it for the week before?
One-on-one, week before. Do it on Wednesday morning. And what I'm interested in are what were the sales to budget, what was the labor cost to budget, and what was the product cost to budget. Because, you know, in our business, that's everything. I mean, certainly there are other costs that are important, but for us, those are the 3 things we focus on, and they'll just give me a 1-minute capsule if something's an exception and what's going to happen about it. And we stand up when we do it, so we don't take too much time.
Wow. Okay. And what time is your day typically in?
Well, actually, I told Bill earlier I was trying to role model having a life. But I typically get home. I typically leave the office at about 6:45 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends. You know, there are nights when I'm in our restaurants or nights when I have other evening business obligations.
Mm-hmm. And you find yourself that when you go out to eat, do you eat in your own restaurants? Or?
Love to.
Yeah.
Love to. I try to do that two or three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, as I mentioned, who's 11, has the most sophisticated 11-year-old palate you can imagine. She actually, this last month, has added escargot and oysters on the half shell to her repertoire.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting.
It's pretty adventurous for an 11-year-old.
Yeah, it's been a yeah, it's great because you know the other if we don't as a family go out, you know we don't get to spend enough time together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's one of the ways that we touch base too.
Now is that you talked about the to sort of tie that back into what we were talking about before? You were talking about your new restaurant,
mm-hmm.
the suburban one. We could talk about Sammamish, but that probably won't mean much to anybody else. And the people are there with families and so forth. Is that part of their thing as well, that they're there with their kids because they're working all the time? And I mean, is that something that we have to pay attention to?
I think we do. That's very interesting because there is a new experience, I think, happening in the country where family traditions, dinner at grandma's house on Sunday, have been replaced by dinner in a restaurant on Sunday or dinner on Wednesday night as a group. And you know, people are so busy now. Gee, you know, between the drive to soccer practice and, you know, flute lessons and, you know, whatever else kids are doing, that families don't always have that opportunity to dine together every night. At our family, in my family, we sit down together every night. Unless there's just no way, unless it's a business obligation, because we don't see each other. We're all on different schedules in the morning, and the three of us don't see each other that much. So we eat dinner together, no TV. That's kind of a rule in our family. But we see, because people don't have the time for preparation, we see that I think the restaurant's taken that place, and I think that's a significant lifestyle change for people, that they have shifted some of those traditions and some of those touch points away from their home to restaurants.
That's
good
for
us. News. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how have you adapted to that? Is there something that you're doing now or something you started doing or stopped doing in response to that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the things that we really started doing that was very important was that we added kids' menus and kid-friendly stuff to even our fine dining restaurants where we have a $55 check average. Because we recognized that people were going to be coming and they were going to be bringing their kids with them, and we needed to provide a good experience for their children while they were there. And so that is critical not only for their experience but other diners' experiences as well. So in restaurants like the Metropolitan Grill, where we didn't have high chairs and we didn't have a kids' menu, we added them. Because we wanted the kids to be taken care of. And those kids, you know, some of those kids are growing up in our restaurants, which is great.
Hmm. How often does that get used? I mean, I wouldn't think, having been to the Metropolitan, I wouldn't think of that as a place that I go with kids. Oh, really?
What do you charge, for example, is that the Metropolitan where you're at the $55 a head?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, what does the kids' menu cost at that?
Only $5. It's like $4.95.
And you can't get an appetizer for $4.95 at the Mac, can you?
Right. And we actually added a small piece of salmon in two of our restaurants because we had kids who were growing out of the typical kids' menu. But we're still really reasonable. I think that's $6.95. I mean, we're looking at...
Well, if you get the parents at $55 a head, you've got a little bit of wiggle room.
That's exactly correct.
Right.
And you know, it doesn't work to have people say, you know, we're going to make this a family restaurant, really. Yeah, it just means that the people who dine with their children bring them.
Welcome.
Yeah, are welcome. Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, when my daughter was smaller, I used to call restaurants and say, even when she was too old for them, do you have high chairs? And if they'd say no, I'd know not to bring her.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So what do you see as changes from here? Are you picking up any trends that you got your nose in the wind a lot?
Yeah. What's going on? Interesting. I think that that family trend is going to continue to be huge, and not so much family dining. I'm not meaning as people taking their children with them regardless. I think that'll continue. I think the time thing is huge, Bill, and it's not just in suburbia, but people want to be able to have leisurely experiences if they want to, but they also, and I think this is maybe a function of our economic environment in the Northwest where things are very good, but they also... Yeah, they don't want to go, and they don't mind paying a lot of money, but they, even for a quick meal. You know, you would think if you're going to go out and spend $55 or $60 for a dining experience,
it should be a three-hour experience.
That's what you'd think, but that's not necessarily true. We have plenty of people who are on their way to somewhere else, whether it's a sporting event or it is just going home, who still want to be able to get their dining experience down to an hour, hour and a half, 15 minutes, hour and 20 minutes, and will still spend the money. So I think that's a responsiveness issue for all of us. And it's not so much that they're antsy during the wait, it's just that they've got really busy 24/7 lives that they're totally wired with cell phones and, pagers and email and everything else, and it just feels like it's rolling. But, well, they're in for that hour and 15 minutes. They want to have escaped from all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the other piece of it. So it's kind of interesting. And the same person will come in and spend the $50 or $60 and only be there for an hour and 15 minutes will come back on another night and spend 3 hours there.
All right, all right. Molly, well, have y'all opened a concept where the numbers just didn't do what y'all thought it was going to do and you had to sit back and rethink? And if that did happen, you know, what was the thought process that they went through?
Oh, let's see, have we ever not opened a concept? That would be the better question, Edmund. Well, Bill and I were just talking about that. We've opened three restaurant operations this year, and in every case we had to sit back for different reasons and think about it. And, you know, say we need to focus it. Interestingly enough, we had, we actually did four because we reconcepted one restaurant. So in that restaurant, we actually did a really interesting thing. It had been a restaurant that we had operated for about 17 years in our community and really needed a huge facelift about 5 years ago. So we totally reconcepted it, made it much more casual than it had been.
This is Hiram's?
Increased frequency, right, that's Hiram's. And it worked okay, but never great. So we decided that we were going to go back to, you know, that retro theme. We were going to go back to what was old was new. And we reconcepted this restaurant back to Hiram's. Well, number one, it was beyond our wildest dreams in terms of successful, in terms of guest counts and the emotional response of people to the restaurant.
No, when you reconcepted the first time, you did or did not change the name?
We did. We totally changed it. We made it a seafood restaurant that was more casual with an Italian theme called Pescatore. So we went about as far from Hiram's, which was steak and seafood, as you can get in the same location. So when we reconcepted and changed the name back, we just had this incredible number of people. I mean, I had a woman walk up to me in the restaurant I'd never seen before in my life, throw her arms around me and kiss me. You know, I mean, we just had stuff like that going on all the time. So so that was one thing that happened. So we said, okay, this is great. This is really cool, and we get it. And the menu changes there have been fairly minor in response to people saying, you know, we did some stuff a little too retro. They didn't want it quite as heavy in some cases as we made it. You know, not quite as much hollandaise sauce, because that had been the old menu. So doing some things there, but those have really been primarily tweaks. And so that was one. We did this other restaurant that Bill and I have been talking about in a suburban area, the Sammamish Plateau, and we made it very thematic. It's called Coconut Beach Grill, and we really made everything relate to that theme of kind of island, beach time, coconut mango, you know, papaya, pineapple, that whole kind of theme. And what we learned from people is that they wanted to go into a place that felt like they were at the beach, but they wanted familiar food.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want pineapple in the rice, and they didn't want focaccia that had, strange...
Coconut nuts.
Yeah, exactly. I started laughing when I knew we had to really back off was a general manager who works for us in another application. I happened to be standing next to him at a social event that our company had, and he was talking to a woman who was not with our company, and she was saying, oh, and what restaurants do you have on the east side? And he started describing the restaurant to her, and he said, and there's coconut in the prawns, and there's coconut in the salad, and there's coconut in the dessert, and there's coconut in the coffee. And I looked at him, and I said, Michael, is that how you felt when you went there? And he goes, yeah, there was coconut in everything. And we said, okay,
whoops.
Now. So we've really walked it way back and in terms of that and gave him, you know, normal rice and you know, normal bread and normal coffee, and it's been great.
But sometimes, you know, you go out to, like, I don't know, are you familiar with Bugaboo Creek?
Yes.
You know, you go out to a Bugaboo Creek and you look at the menu and you go, well, you know, this is an Outback menu with animal heads on the wall.
That's right.
You know?
That's exactly correct. And that's what people were saying. We like the palm trees. They're really nice.
Mm-hmm.
But can you give us some normal food on our plate?
Mm-hmm.
So that was another example of having a stand back.
But that sort of goes against a lot of things that, you know, Bill and I have talked about over the years about making your place unique and having some integrity, you know, from the menu, you know, all the way out.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and now what I'm hearing, and what a lot of times I do see, you know, is that, well, you know, we should, you know, follow the theme, but let's not go too crazy with the food.
Well, you know, here's a question. Who are you developing restaurants for? Is it for you or is it for the guest?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we tend to think we're normal people.
Right.
We're normal eaters, but, you know,
right.
Even with frequency, I don't know, a lot of people are going to fine dining restaurants two or three nights a week, like I told you I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it really puts you in a different perspective.
Sure.
Well, I noticed that a lot in Chicago. A lot of restaurants in Chicago seem to be developed for other restaurateurs.
Right.
Rather than to be particularly guest-friendly.
Well, don't you think you can do that if you have big enough density, you know?
Yeah, you probably could. I mean, if you're in the middle of, you know, downtown, but not that many people are.
Right.
Well, but don't you think that some of the people going to, I mean, a lot of people that are going to Chicago or traveling to Chicago are relatively more sophisticated? Maybe not?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, that's an interesting question. We have a large restaurant group that operates from Seattle Restaurants Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have a very good experience in Chicago. I'm sure that on the return they certainly will, but they didn't have a very good experience because I think that they made some assumptions about sophistication, and I also know that the wrong way, and I also know that the Kimpton Group, which operates both hotels and restaurants, found that when they came in with their Tulio and I think they did a French bistro concept in Chicago, thinking that, you know, they were looking at other operators and thinking they were fairly sophisticated, that what they found was actually that they were trying to make it too hip for the Chicago market.
Right.
And had to back it down.
Right.
Well, I think that you get to the question of, do I want to be the place where people go on special occasions? Do I want to be the place they go five times a month?
Right.
But yeah, but a lot of time, talking from my perspective, being a little guy, it's very difficult to be the place to go five times a month.
Mm-hmm.
So because there's so many players in that arena already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. But I also, I guess it depends on your location. You know, we're downtown at the Metropolitan Grill in Seattle. We don't expect, well, we have people come for lunch five times a week. But, you know, typically for dinner, you know, we're not seeing the average guest five times a month, but again, there's a tremendous amount of density and people dining. So, you know, for a couple times a month, if people come in a couple times a month, we're pretty happy about that.
Yeah.
I guess in a suburban location, though, you know, depending on their dining frequency, you know, it depends on how many people there are to draw from. You need them to come in four times a month.
As far as your frequent dining program, your VIP program, mm-hmm. is going, are you using a frequent dining card and so forth, and is that applicable throughout each one of the concepts? I mean, can I go to Steamers or the Metropolitan Grill and use the same card?
Well, that's kind of interesting because, no, and that's been a little bit of a question. We're kind of a, I think, different company in this way. First of all, the VIP program is not the same as any kind of dining discount.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because what we really found is what people wanted was exactly what you and Bill have been working on. They want recognition. They want to be able to call and get a reservation the same day. They want free valet parking, as an example, and then they also want to feel included. So they want to know what's happening with the restaurant, and we have some special events for them too. Like we'll do cookbook signings sometimes with authors, or do wine releases when a new vintage is released in our region, and invite our frequent guests to come to that. But we're really not giving them discounts. We do some programs in steamers, as an example, like a lunch punch program or that kind of thing, but that's really a different program. And as far as connecting it between the restaurants, we always recognize a VIP from one more restaurant to the other if they're calling. But what we really know is that people want to look at our restaurants, which are individually concepted, as their place, and they understand that it's part of a family of restaurants, but they want it to be a unique and special experience for them.
Don't really want that rubbed in their face.
They don't.
Yeah.
Huh. So, you know, we... So that's how we do it. They want the recognition. And frequently what will also happen is a management person or hospitality person will know that one of the VIPs wants to go to one of the other restaurants and be well taken care of, so they actually are making the reservations for them. You know, they kind of become their concierge in that way.
Hmm.
That works too. You know, technology is going to change all that, though.
You think?
Everybody's online and you're all looking at the same... you know, guests and know the guest frequency and that kind of stuff.
Are you using the internet to or email to reach your guests, or are you still doing traditional newsletters?
We actually don't do newsletters. We do letters to them when something's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Our newsletter is internal for our internal customers, our crew, but we don't do newsletters to the guests. I find that it's really hard to do one really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes an extraordinary amount of effort, and there aren't very many I read. There's a local operator here that does a great one, I think, because his name's Tom Douglas, and he operates the Palace Kitchen, Etta's, the Dahlia Lounge here locally. And Tom is really a non-politically correct, off-the-wall kind of guy, in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just start laughing when I read his newsletter, because he's always got kind of the opening salvo in there, and
you kind of get Tom.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, his last one was about the kind of music you need to cook by, and he was talking about walking into one of his kitchens and Jane's Addiction was playing in the kitchen, and he said he learned two things. One is he hates Jane's Addiction, you know, ditto there. You know, that really heavy duty rock thing is not going to be for me. And number two, he said, it is not conducive to cooking great food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're cooking Italian, it needs to be, you know, Puccini, and if it's, you know, ribs, it better be Louis Armstrong, and, you know, so he's doing a music education program with... Like, I just thought was great, but, you know, that's the kind of stuff that makes a newsletter worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also, in his newsletter, talks about other restaurants that are new in town. And trips he takes other cities and about the great restaurants he sees there. So he's got this following of people who really love food and like the restaurant scene, and they really feel like Tom knows, and he's cluing them in.
I mean, but he doesn't actually, if he has a bad experience on a new restaurant, he's not actually saying that, is he?
Oh, no. He's when I say he's not necessarily PC, I mean in the most, you know, loving way. No.
Calls it like he sees it.
Yeah. So we don't, you know, I think he does a great newsletter. I think he's rare. Most of the other newsletters I get, you know, because I'm trying to get on everybody's list, I look at them and think, yeah, that wasn't worth the effort.
I might have to give a call and get on the list for his. That sounds like fun.
You should get on the call. And Maureen Miller is his person there, and call Maureen and ask her to put you on their list, because the recipes are always great, too. And he always has people who are culinary professionals on his team talking about what they love, and, you know, just he'll do different stuff. He'll have everybody do what's your greatest memory, you know, what's your greatest food memory, or talk about your greatest restaurant experience, or, you know, what's your favorite dish and why. And they'll write about it and give a recipe, and it's fun.
Bill, when you call, will you put my name and address down on that, too?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure, I will. See, the only hard part about sitting down and spending time with Molly is that you could do it for days.
I know.
And we've already had her for an hour, and you're trying to have a life, and I appreciate you're sort of detouring for this.
No problem.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks,
Bill.
Thanks for that, and we must do lunch sometime.
All right. Yeah, give me a call. I'll buy.
I will do it.
All right.
Great.
Sure.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks,
guys.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.